begin. So thank you all for joining us at this late hour to learn some Torah at the end of the week. We're in the month of Kislev. We had originally thought to do this on Rosh Chodesh, but it's close enough between Rosh Chodesh and Chanukah to think a little bit about this month, to think a little bit about, get ourselves kind of in the mindset for the Chag. So we'll begin with a background, which probably everybody's familiar with, and we'll ask kind of one basic question that we're going to try to discover, uncover, and look at. So I brought the Rambam Hilchot Chanukah, which is here in source number one, and what you might want to think about as we go through, feel free to pipe in with comments and questions and anything that comes to mind as we go along, is the Rambam sharing anything that you never heard about in terms of Chanukah? So he's going to share a lot about the story and the background that you hopefully are familiar with, and if there's any details in here that struck you as, oh, I never knew that, I never thought about that, I'm curious where that came from, feel free to share along the way or when we get to the end of the source. So the Rambam, interesting side note, the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, which is the book of Jewish law, the Rambam put together, 14 volumes. So in the section called Zmanim, which is the section where the Rambam speaks about the Jewish calendar, essentially, he has one book called Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah. So he puts together the laws of Purim and the laws of Chanukah, which makes sense because they're both rabbinic holidays. They're both holidays that were not explicitly recorded in the Torah. We have obviously Megillat Esther. Chanukah doesn't even have a text, an official text that's part of Tanakh. Although the timing of Chanukah wasn't necessarily that far off from the time of Tanakh. It happened during the second Beit HaMikdash, as the Rambam tells us in the first line here. But the Rambam put these two together because they naturally go together as holidays that are rabbinic in nature. And the laws of Purim take up the first two chapters, and the laws of Chanukah take up, I believe, the third and fourth chapter of the book. So just some background information of why this appears in the third chapter as opposed to earlier on. The laws of Chanukah begin officially in the third chapter of these halachot. So let's look inside source number one. And this English translation, this one I took from Chabad.org, is the entire Mishneh Torah translated into English. So shout out to Chabad on that one. In the era of the Second Temple, the Greek kingdom issued decrees against the Jewish people, attempting to nullify their faith and refusing to allow them to observe the Torah and its commandments. They extended their hands against their property and their daughters. They entered the sanctuary, wrought havoc within, and made the sacraments impure. The Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly until the God of our ancestors had mercy upon them, delivered them from their hand, and saved them. So you might be hearing like the words from Al-Hanisim in your head, if you remember some of them and how those are translated. The sons of the Chashmonaim, the high priests, overcame them, slew them, and saved the Jews from their hand. The end of the first halakha, he writes, they appointed a king from the priests and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. This is historical background and gives us some information on what things were going on, what the Jews faced as a community at that time. Anybody want to point anything out that they noticed? Something interesting, something different that you never thought before? Sounds pretty much in line with what you might have heard before about the Chag. Something that is interesting is that the Rambam doesn't usually teach us history in a book of halakha. Most of the Mishneh Torah, I would say the overwhelming majority, 99.9% of the passages of, I don't know how many words in halachot are actually make up the entire Mishneh Torah. I said before, it's 14 volumes. Each volume has anywhere between 3 to 6 separate books, topics, categories, and each one has, you know, could have 5, 6, some have 20 chapters in them. So you do the math, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of chapters of Jewish law. And pretty much all of them just talk about Jewish law. The Rambam wasn't writing a history book. So it is interesting that here he puts into code history. Not the question we're going to discuss. It's just something interesting to think about when you study the text of the Rambam. So here in the first paragraph, seems like pretty standard, pretty straightforward information. We'll come back. If you have a thought along the way, let me know. Let's look at the next halakha. When the Jews overcame their enemies and destroyed them, so here in the middle where it says the number 2, they entered the sanctuary. This was the 25th of Kislev. They could not find any pure oil in the sanctuary with the exception of a single cruse. It contained enough oil to burn for merely one day. They lit the arrangement of candles from it for 8 days until they could crush olives and produce pure oil. So far, so good. Sounds like the Hanukkah story to everyone. Okay. Accordingly, the sages of that generation ordained that these 8 days, which begin from the 25th of Kislev, should be commemorated to be days of happiness and praise of God. Candles should be lit in the evening at the entrance of the houses, and on each and every one of these 8 nights to publicize and reveal the miracle. These days are called Chanukah. It's forbidden to eulogize and fast on them as on the days of Purim. Lighting the candles on these days is a rabbinic mitzvah, like the reading of the Megillah. And from that point, the Rambam starts to go into the actual detailed halachot and detailed laws of Chanukah. Anything off or different or strange in any of these pieces? Doesn't have to be, but I'm curious if anybody saw or noticed something. And then I'll ask my question.
Well, the Rambam only talks about the miracle of the oil. He doesn't talk about the miracle of the war at all.
Right, very good. So that is a very large discussion about how the miracle is focused on in different Jewish texts. So it's called the Gemara. It would be one place where you would find a section about Chanukah. Al Hanisim would be a different place where the rabbis put together a text that talks about this miracle, this time of history, and what they focus on in the Al Hanisim is very different than what they focus on in the Gemara. Al Hanisim focuses on primarily, I know it's not here on the page, but if anybody remembers, primarily focuses on the miracle of the war, mm-hmm. Right? Rabim biyad me'atim, the great in the hands of the small, right? In the hands of the many, opposite, so on and so forth. And it speaks a little bit about the hidliku shmona yimei Chanukah elu. It's like at the end, it's like a postscript, like a P.S. There was also this miracle, but the war is a much bigger deal in the Al Hanisim that ends up being part of our tefillah. Whereas in the passage in the Gemara, which there is no Masechet Chanukah in Talmud Bavli, or Talmud Yerushalmi for that matter, they focus much more on the oil. They focus much more on what happened in the Beit HaMikdash, what happened in that time, and bringing back the ability to relight the menorah and rededicate the Mikdash. And that is also an interesting question, why we might focus on one or the other. Was one miracle greater than the other? Was one miracle less great? All very important questions to consider. What I noticed, and I actually put it in italics, but no one said anything, it's in the second line in source number 1, is the Rambam mentions refusing to allow them to observe the Torah. Now, in the Al Hanisim, the phrase is l'hashkicham toratecha, which means to cause them to forget the Torah, from the word lishkoach, shichecha, in Hebrew. So, to cause them to forget the Torah is different than refusing to allow them to keep the Torah. He says to observe the Torah. And what is actually strange about this is even if the Rambam would have founded his statement based on what it says in Al Hanisim, which is possible because Al Hanisim text was probably written by the rabbis of the Gemara, the source for that is kind of fuzzy. No one's really sure where it comes from that the Greeks actually tried to prevent us from Torah, from observation of the Torah. Go ahead. What are you remembering?
Just more of a clarification. If one is, what was the first one you said? Not one is refusing to allow them to observe.
Right.
And the other one
to
is...
to cause them to forget.
So causing them to forget is pretty much enticing them to be Hellenists. Mm-hmm. Or like with the modern world.
Okay, good.
Right, that I guess is very different than saying no Torah.
Okay, so if you want to ruin the whole shiur already, you know, no, you're good. You're on the right track, and that's a very important point. How we define what does it mean to prevent us, and what does it mean to make us to forget is a very important question, which we're definitely gonna address that. The other thing to think about is we'll bring it. I'm going to bring the source a little bit later. The official I would say the most famous source that's quoted on what the Greeks tried to push, or kind of reject, make the Jews stop doing, prevent them from doing, were three mitzvot: Rosh Chodesh, Brit Milah, and Shabbat. There are others quoted in some other sources, but those are kind of like the three big ones, and already a question on its own, why those three, and what is it about those three? There's many, many wonderful topics in Chanukah to look at and think about. But nowhere in these original sources of Midrashim, the Gemara, you won't find anywhere a reference to the Torah being taken away, or the Greeks, you know, you have that Midrash about, I don't even know if it's a Midrash, but as little kids we learned they were learning Torah, and then when the Greeks came they were playing dreidels and, yeah, or whatever, that's where the minhag of dreidel, whatever they were playing, gambling, cards, whatever they were doing. I don't know where that source is from. I'm sure there's some kind of source to that, but the idea that Torah was something that the Greeks were trying to take away does not seem to be in the sources anywhere. So I want to look at that. I want to explore that, and I want to explore a little bit of what the Greeks were really trying to do, and why what they were really trying to do is maybe undermining something much, much more fundamental than just these examples of what we said, Rosh Chodesh. We'll see that source in a little bit. So we're going to jump back in history, and I'll just give a few points of where the background to this is, and it's a Gemara in Masechet Megillah. It's in source number 2, and it's a story of when the Torah was first translated into another language. The first time in history when the Torah was translated into another language, and that language was
Greek.
So I want to give a little background to what was going on and when this took place, because it didn't take place around the time of Chanukah. It took place about 100 years before. Okay, but the Greeks were already a powerful empire at that point. So let's just do a quick 1 minute recap of what was going on in history. So we're going back from today, I did the math, 2,369 years ago, the second Beit HaMikdash was built. Okay, 2,369 years ago, not today necessarily, but that year, okay, was the year of the building of the second temple. And we know the very famous king who enabled us to be able to do that, his name was Koresh. Koresh was the Persian, non-Jewish king of Persia, and he funded part of the building, and he encouraged the Jews to make aliyah and to leave his land and go back to Israel. A very significant personality from a non-Jewish nation who really fueled the beginning of that time. So he was king for 34 years, and then another famous guy came on the scene. His name was Alexander Mokdon, also known as Alexander the Great. He came, captured Jerusalem, and that's what began the Greek rule, the Greek Empire. That was the beginning of the Greek Empire. 12 years later, okay, if you're doing the math, it's 46 years total, Alexander the Great dies. Then Greek gets split off into a number of different rulers, 4 to be exact. One of them, his name was Ptolemaeus Harishon, Ptolemaeus the First, and he was king in Egypt. We're getting to the end of the story. He was there for 30 years, okay? And when he died, his son took over, and he was called Ptolemaeus the Second, also known as Ptolemy, okay? The guy in the story we're about to read about. Ptolemy, the P is silent. I don't know how that works or why that works, but that's who we're talking about. So we're basically in the early years of the Greek Empire, and he has this idea that the Torah should be accessible to us, to the world, and the world at that point was the Greek Empire, at least in that region. And that's what everybody was speaking. That's the language everybody was speaking. So here's what happened. Source number 2. There was an incident involving King Ptolemy of Egypt, who assembled 72 elders. The reason why some is bold and some is not, this translation is taken from Sepharia, which is a wonderful, I'm giving all the plugs in my recording for all of the various websites that I use. Sepharia has an English translation of the Talmud Bavli. Almost the entire Talmud has been translated. They've taken the Steinsaltz edition of the English. So the bold words are literal translations of the words, and then what they've done is they've filled in the gaps with other words. For those who've studied Talmud before, the words don't always fit if you just translate them literally. So they fill it in with these other words. So there was an incident with this king. He assembled 72 elders from the sages of Israel and put them into 72 separate rooms and did not reveal to them for what purpose he assembled them. So they wouldn't be able to communicate and coordinate their responses. He entered and he approached each and every one and said to each of them, write for me a translation of the Torah of Moses, your teacher. Now, they all had to know Greek as well to be able to do this. The Holy One, blessed be He, placed wisdom in the heart of each and every one, and they all agreed to one common understanding. Now, if that wasn't miraculous already, the next part is even more miraculous. I cut this passage short just for the sake of time, and we're not really studying this for the story itself, but you'll see in a minute where it's going. So not only did they all translate the text correctly, they all introduced the same changes into the translated text. They were worried, I'll show you one or two examples in a minute that I brought here in this story, they were worried that certain words or psukim or references, especially in the creation story in Bereshit, would set people off to think that the Jews are heretical. They have all these different references to God not just being one God. Sounds like there's more than one God. You'll see one or two examples in a moment. And they wrote for him, Bereshit. They wrote Bereshit bara Elohim. So they wrote Elohim bara Reshit. They actually changed the order in their version, in the translation version that they gave the king. They changed the order of the first three words of the Torah. Now, you could say, how could they do that? You're changing the words of the Torah. The answer is, they didn't change the Hebrew text. They changed the Greek translation version of it, so that when he would read it, it would read, God created in the beginning. Now, we all know Bereshit bara Elohim doesn't mean Bereshit created God. If you translate it literally, that's what it would mean, right? Something called Bereshit. There's some power in the world that was there before God, and that's what created God, Bereshit bara Elohim. That's literal translation, right? So they were worried that if we translate it that way, then they're going to think, right, there is a power that was here before God. So what did they do? They changed the wording and they said, Elohim, bara Reshit, God was the one who made it all, who started the whole story, right? Reversing the order of the words in the first phrase of the Torah that could be misinterpreted as Bereshit created God. They did so to negate those who believe in the pre-existence of the world and those who maintain that there are two powers in the world, which was probably, I'm not a Greek philosophy person, unless there's someone at the table who knows Greek philosophy, probably, I would imagine, something that they were starting to talk about within Greek philosophy. So they were worried about this. And one is Bereshit, who created the second God. And they wrote, I shall make man in my image and in likeness. So what does it actually say? Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu. We. So over there, everybody asks the question, what does it mean, we? God and who else is going to create man? God on his own is going to create man. So I'd say, Na'aseh. Anybody remember the Rashi on that pasuk? Right. That God consulted with the angels. Right? This shows humility, that God doesn't do things without having some kind of conversation with other beings. I don't understand what that means either, but at least it helps us figure out why the text is using plural when it's speaking about one God. So they did all this, and the Gemara goes on and lists numbers of examples. You imagine all these 72 rabbis sitting in 72 different rooms. Not only did they have the exact same translation, they also had the exact same changes in the text. So the whole thing is beyond comprehension, how this whole thing actually was able to come to fruition. And otherwise, if there would have been one difference, he would have known. He would have caught them on it, right? So here's the strange part. After this happened, what would you have done if you were the Jewish community? They come back. Now we have a translation that probably would also benefit Jewish people. I'm not going to probably... wouldn't be too far off if we guessed that there were probably Jews at that time who didn't speak Hebrew. Or at the very least, now the Torah can be accessible by
everybody
right? This is great. This is wonderful. We can spread our knowledge to the world. Pardon?
Well, same thing happened in Germany.
Torah Shebichtav is permissible.
Same thing happened in Germany.
Written Torah.
Yeah, but I don't know, like, today things, in any generation, something changes. People say, oh no.
I'm with you.
We can't do it.
We're going to talk about that in a moment. You're right.
Oh yeah, it's a great idea.
Anything that you translate, yeah. Lost in translation. There's no question. Even the English translation, if you don't understand the Hebrew language, that it's going to be part of it. But the question is this something to celebrate or is this something to be sad about? Right. Is this something to do the opposite, as we'll see in a moment?
I kind of think of it as like the pre-art scroll, art scroll. Like, it was, like, the very first art scroll Tanakh. Like, I mean, people have different opinions about art scroll, but it makes it so much more accessible. Like, you can, like, someone who's never...
Yeah, so you look and you say, I'm just saying straight, you just ask someone, you know, speak about, take any translation that was made famous, let's call it, let's use art scroll for example, okay? So you have the stone edition, everybody knows what that is. You go anywhere in the world, they'll know exactly what you're talking about, at least in the Orthodox community. And take the Talmud Bavli, for example. The number of people today that study Talmud, study Gemara, Daf Yomi, for example, is just a good example of it. It's in the tens of thousands, who knows, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, not only because it was made accessible by art scroll, but large contributing factor. They were like the first ones to say, we're going to take this on in a significant way. There were others who did it before, but not in the same fashion. Go ahead.
I totally hear that, and I agree with it to some point. For example, I never learned how to read Gemara, and I can read the Bavli Talmud, right? Not because I use Koran, right?
Okay.
Koran is great. It's very accessible. It has pictures.
Yeah.
Explains everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a great resource, but I also think I like history, and I look at history of people who attacked Jews, right? So if you talk about Christian history, this is before, I believe, Christianity even exists.
Yeah, long before.
Long before. And then they were using probably the English or whatever language they were speaking,
right.
Septuagint, to say, oh, well, you...
Very good.
Sacrifice people on Passover, so really you're going to kill my child, so now we're going to kill all of you.
Yeah. It's a great
so
point.
Things like that.
Yeah. Using the text in the wrong way, 100%.
It's a double-edged sword.
What are they going to do with it now that they have it in their language?
And then they killed, you know.
Yeah.
The same thing happened in Germany, for example, like with the Reform movement, like who was Mendelssohn, like he had to convert, translate into German.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of rabbis were freaking out. They're like, oh, this is where biblical criticism is going to come from.
And
this is the birth of biblical criticism. Like,
right.
We're going to say it comes from anywhere.
Yeah.
100%. And they did. Like, if you talk of Plato, whatever, all these.
So the rabbis agreed with you. The rabbis agreed with you, and they called a fast day, okay? They call the fast day. Look in source number 3. The Shulchan Aruch actually codes this. We don't keep this fast day today, but it is written in the Halakha, along with a whole list of other fast days that we don't keep today. And the Shulchan Aruch goes into this long section of fast days that are all like for the... Some of them are, you know, like when Aaron HaKohen died. Like there's some that... You've not even heard that they made a fast day for such a thing. And then it gives a long list. And then when it gets up to the month of Tevet, it goes month by month, different events that happen. Bishmona b'Tevet, the 8th day of Tevet. So we already have a fast on the 10th of Tevet. So I don't know if they necessarily wanted to put two fasts one day apart. Literally. Nichtava ha-Torah Yivanit. Bimei Talmai ha-Melech. The Torah was written, translated into Greek, in the days of Talmai the king. And look at the language here. V'aya choshech ba'olam shlosha yamim. There was darkness in the world for 3 days. So you talk about a negative impact, or at least the way it was perceived. I don't know what that means. There was darkness in the world, but you could see that as depression. People were very saddened by this event, and they didn't see this as something positive at all. And the question really is, I agree with all the points that were made before, that extreme, to go and have a fast day, maybe not to do anything, maybe to celebrate on some level, because it is an accomplishment, despite the negative outcomes, but just the event itself, the fact that these people were able to separately, and do what they did. So I want to explore that a little bit with a beautiful comment from Rav Avigdor Nevinsohn, who's still very much part of... the rabbinic community, older rabbinic community in Israel. He was chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, Ir HaAtikah, specifically the Old City. I had an opportunity to study in the same yeshiva where he was there daily and got to speak to him many times. A very amazing person, and he wrote, always writing and always sharing Torah. So he said the following. So we're going to study it. I'll translate it as we go along, looking in the right column. So first he says the question that I just mentioned, Lichora, hayat tzarich likbo yom tov al nes kazeh. You should really make a yom tov. You should really make this a holiday on such a great miracle. Sheshivim vishnaim zekenim kivnu ledavar achad. These 72 sages were all able to focus on one translation. Echad b'lili hityareitz b'ininahem. They didn't have conversation among each other. They didn't talk to each other. They didn't have a way to communicate. Aval chazal lo kavu yom tov lezecha merazel atanit. They made a fast day out of it. It was a miracle, but on a day of a miracle, they're making a fast day. It's kind of strange. Megillah Tanit is a Megillah where it's not a Megillah like we have the Megillot. It's called like a scroll of the Jewish community. And the Jewish community had this scroll, and in that scroll, they had different dates in the year. Dates where bad things happen and good things happen. Days where you're not allowed to have a fast day at all, not even for a personal fast day or communal fast day. And then there's days where you do fast. So the end of the first paragraph says, our community today, you know, 20th century, we don't keep this fast. Aval b'slichot, it is mentioned, in the slichot on Asar b'tevet. So if you're in Shul or you're looking in a Sidur, around that time of the year, which will be in a couple of weeks, Asar b'tevet, you'll find in there a mention in the slichot of this event, when the Torah was translated into Greek, and that's considered something that we say in the slichot, which is usually associated with sad, you know, occasions. Second paragraph, what's the big deal? Changing the Torah into transforming the Torah, translating into another language. Why did they make a fast day for this? Chazal understood it's a very bad situation, a very bad crisis for the Jewish people. L'talmai ulai lo etashum kavanah rabbah. And by the way, the king didn't necessarily have a bad intention with it. Aval chazal beruach kodesham ra'u shehanezek aruchani, the spiritual damage that was going to result mitirgum zeh yeh gadol mil. They foresaw something very negative coming out of this. Tirgum haTorah liyevanit harei yigrom lekach sheyudim yoshvim in Mitzrayim v'shar ha'atzot yevanio, wherever the Jews are, whether they're in Egypt or whether in other Greek parts of the empire, lo yitrchu od l'mod et lashon hakodesh. They're going to stop learning Hebrew. They're going to stop learning the holy language. Ima Torah mitirgemet liyevanit lama litroch l'mod et lashon hakodesh. And it's very true. If you have the opportunity to study something in English, what's the likelihood of you trying to break your teeth studying Hebrew, if you don't have that as a background or as a language that you spoke at home? It's not so likely. It's much more challenging, much more time-consuming, much more, it's like embarrassing, I guess, even to a level. Like, I don't know, I can't read it. Daila dad at a safai of any, it was enough. The Greek translation was a good translation. You had 72 rabbis signed on. When do you ever have 72 rabbis agreeing on anything, you know? I heard someone say a joke on this week's Parsha. That when Yaakov falls asleep with the dream, with the ladder, and then he wakes up and he says, "Ein zeh kim beit Elokim v'zeh shar shemaim." He realizes that, which is maybe where they get the name of the shul, but he realizes, yeah, from there. So he realizes that he's in a holy place. He realizes, and that's what the Chazal tells us, the Har Moriah, right? He was in the Temple Mount. He was in the holiest place in the world. So you say, what's the connection? Like, what made him realize that? So they say it's based on the beginning of the story where he wants to go to sleep and he's looking for a pillow. There's only rocks, so he takes a bunch of rocks. Now, there's different commentaries, but the one that I think most people are familiar with is the 12 rocks, and they fight. They all want to have a place to put their head under Yaakov, under his head, and then they all have to get combined into one, right? So they stop fighting. So Yaakov realized, of course it's a shul, of course it's a Beit HaMikdash, if it's all the Jews are fighting, everyone's fighting to try to get a place, it must be a Beit El, it must be a holy place. Anyways, that's how he knew he was in a shul. But a more serious note, the idea behind it, right, is that there's something very special about the language. And die la die. You could just say, what do I need to bother with any other language? And again, there, they probably could speak. He says, Shabbat Shalom Deber Meshchenim HaGoyim V'gam L'morot. You can learn with them. You can learn with your neighbors, right? Mimela, bottom of that paragraph, Kama Ra'ot Alulot Litzmoch Mizeh, and continues on the left side. Number one, few kind of negative outcomes. He lists four things that seem to be negative outcomes of this. Number one, Lashon HaKodesh Alulot Lishtakeh. People are just going to forget the Hebrew language altogether. Which, by the way, happened, right? It happened for pretty much a very large chunk of history until even before the state of Israel was established, but that was obviously accelerated the rate at which, and today it's a miracle. It really is a miracle, the revival of Hebrew, of Hebrew language, and you go to Israel and you hear Hebrew on the street wherever you go, and it's really something that, besides for all the other wonderful things that we have in Israel, the fact that there's a language that's our language that people are speaking again is something very, very unique. HaTorah, second one, HaTorah lo tiyan yomedet ve'otach kedusha, kamo shenil medad achshav. The Torah is not going to be studied with the same holiness, with the same kedusha that was until that point. Omnam, gam Torah shenil medet b'yivanit hikedusha. It's true, it's still Torah. Torah is Torah, but it's Torah in Greek. Aval ein zeh otach kedusha kamo limud b'lashon hakodesh. And that has its ramifications in other areas as well. For example, in tefillah, there's a halacha that you can pray in any language. You pray in the language that you understand most, except for one line in all of tefillah, Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's the only line in tefillah that you're supposed to say and understand what you're saying in Lashon HaKodesh. So it's just an interesting concept that there's even within prayer, something that we say must be said in the original idea, the original language that it was given in. Third, harbeh midrashot chazal lo nitnot lahavana kasher haTorah mitergemet liyivanit. What about all of the oral Torah, right? All of the midrashim, all of the interpretations of the Torah, many of them, he says, are based on dikduk, on the way a word is spelled, or the way a word is pronounced, right? Gematriot, the numerical value of letters, as we know, al roshei tevot, sometimes you have acronyms, achaserot, yeterot, some of these words spelled with a yud, spelled without a yud. And these are all things that the rabbis spend like pages and pages discussing what the meaning of these things are. And if it's taken out of its original language, you're going to lose all of that rich interpretation and rich literature that's been discussed. So on. That's the third one. The fourth one, Terguma Torah Yivanit Alul Lahavot Petach Gadol Hitbolulut. This is the other one, assimilation. Right? It opens up the ability for people to feel comfortable in other circles. Because Shemit Raglim Ladaber B'Safar Agoyim, you start talking that language. You're mentioning Germany before as a great example. Nifka, by the way, I didn't bring the rest of it, but his next paragraph he talks about reform, the reform movement as. That was one of the first things that began that kind of schism in the Jewish community was the language. And I think he mentions it elsewhere, but many others say it as well. It's one of the reasons why we were redeemed from Egypt. That the rabbis tell us that we didn't change our language. People just continued to speak. And I'll mention one more thing about that in a moment, in the next source. Not just the language. Language might be the first thing to go, but then it may lead to other cultural adoptions that end up crumbling the foundations of our own rich culture. Kamuvan zeudavar garua shisrael shebedor hahu yikablu atarbut yavan. And the Hellenistic culture, as we know, was very, very powerful. Very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Captivating.
Enticing. Thank you. Exactly. Enticing. Captivating. Al zeach arkach nilchamu achashmonaim, and that's what they fought against. The Saleka Tarbut Yavan, which, by the way, that's goes back to the question of which was the bigger victory. It's tied into that question because the victory wasn't just okay. Now we can light the menorah again. It represented something more. The war was maybe a great thing that we didn't get destroyed, or we were able to overcome the enemies. But maybe the menorah represented a spiritual victory. Which a number of commentaries talk about how Hanukkah and Purim are kind of polar opposites in the way that we celebrate the Chag. Purim is a very physical type of celebration. Hanukkah is a very spiritual type of celebration. There's no obligation to have a meal, a festive meal on Hanukkah. It's nice to do it, but there's no obligation. Whereas Purim, there is that central feature of the day. That the Hellenistic culture to fight that, push that back. So some maybe understandings of why the rabbis decided we're going to make this into a fast day as opposed to a celebration. Just to draw on a moment in this week's Parsha, the end of this week's Parsha, in source number 5, the end of the whole story where Yaakov and Lavan split ways and separate ways, they make a pact, or we call it a pact, they make more of like a negotiation, a truce, I'm going to call it that, and they say, here's a wall, you go your way, and I'm going to go my way, and they actually gave it a name. So they gave it two names. They gave it one name, and they each said it in their language. So the way it's described here is Yaakov said to his people who were with him, gather the stones, they took the stones, they made a pile, they had a little meal there. Lavan called it Yagar Sahaduta, which is, I believe, Aramaic. And Yaakov called it Galed. Galed would be the Hebrew equivalent of the name Yagar Sahaduta. So this is, again, Rav Nevenzahl in his essay. He says something very simple question. He says, throughout Tanakh, we have many many personalities who spend time in foreign countries with foreign leaders, probably speaking the language of those places. Okay, Yosef is a great example. Yosef was given another name, right? When he went down to Egypt, they gave him the name Tzafnat Paneach. In all likelihood, he was speaking Egyptian, or whatever the equivalent of Egyptian in that time of history. And you have even like within the story of Balak and Bilam, right, who tried to curse the people. They were probably speaking Moabite, I would imagine, some form of some other kind of language. Now, the Torah doesn't tell us that story in their native language. It tells us the story in Hebrew. It tells us the story in Lashon HaKodesh. This is the only place, at least in Chamishi Chumshei Torah, where you have someone telling you. And probably up until this point, Yaakov was probably speaking Lavan's language, Lavan's native language, whatever, call it Aramaic, that's what he was speaking. So all of a sudden, the Torah uses this Aramaic term to describe the place where he lived, or the place where they were making this this truce, this pact. It's very strange. What does it mean? What's the reason behind it? So Rav Nevenzahl says, is that this was the moment where Yaakov and Lavan were parting ways. And Yaakov was going to go back to Eretz Yisrael, and he was going to start his life over there, far away from Lavan as he could get. And what happened was, what they were doing was Yaakov was saying to Lavan, where you come from, it's called Yagar Sahaduta, meaning your place is a different language, it's not my language. Granted, that's what it's called, but that's, I want you to know that I still speak Lashon HaKodesh. I kept my identity all these 20 plus years that I've been in your house, and you've tried to influence me, and you've tried to influence my family. I've kept my Lashon HaKodesh. And he finishes his kind of relationship with Lavan with the statement of, I kept my identity strong. And I want you to know, maybe in your town you call it Galei, but where I come from, this rock formation is called, sorry, Yagar Saduta, this is where I come from, this rock formation is called Galei. And as we know, in next week's Parsha, he uses the phrase of Im Lavan Garti, and Rashi says Vitaryag Mitzvot Shamarti. He tells when he meets Esav, he wants him to know, you know, when I was there, I lived with him, but I was able to hold strong in what I believe in. So there's a message here about what the Greeks were not necessarily trying to do at that time. Maybe they were trying to do it more explicitly 100 years later with the Hanukkah story. Okay, just a digression for a minute about Lashon HaKodesh. Is there a mitzvah to learn Hebrew? There seems to be two sources that speak about this, two explicit sources that speak about this. One is in source 6, actually maybe three sources. Is a Tosefta. Tosefta is a very authoritative text. It's basically additions to the Mishnah. So this Tosefta is found in Masechet Chagiga, and it talks about all kinds of different things you're supposed to teach children. So one of the things you're supposed to teach children is once a child. And basically it goes like this. It says, once a child is able to do X, then we teach them Y. So once they're able to, and it goes through kind of a list of all kinds of different activities, we start to educate them according, it's like developmental psychology 101. As they get older and as they're able to speak and as they're able to understand, as they're able to do things, we give them more tasks. So eventually when they become bar bat mitzvah, they'll be able to do them, full-fledged. So he says, Yodei ledaber, once they know how to speak, aviv melamdo shma, v'torah v'lashon hakodesh. It's a very interesting concept, right? Three things a parent is supposed to teach their child, shma, Torah, and lashon hakodesh. So shma, parents do that with their kids when they're very young, shma Yisrael, before they go to bed. Torah, of course, teaching Torah, Lashon HaKodesh. How many people are teaching their kids Hebrew from a very young age? If they're in Israel, okay, it's good. If they're not in Israel, it's an interesting source for that idea. And then there's another source in source 7, V'limadatem otam b'neichem l'daber bam, right? Which the simple interpretation of that is probably speaking about Shema itself, saying of Shema. Rashi brings from this, the rabbis derive their teaching when he begins to speak. His followers should speak with him the Holy Tongue. This is where it comes from. The source for that, for what I just said above, is from that from those words, l'daber bam, to speak of them, meaning the language itself. And then there's the Rambam in Pirkei Avot, who says on the Mishnah, you should be careful about a mitzvah kala like you would be careful about a mitzvah chamura. So what's the difference between mitzvah kala and mitzvah chamura? Mitzvah kala is a light mitzvah. Mitzvah chamura is a heavier mitzvah, a more weighty mitzvah, something that has more important mitzvah, you might call it, which we don't really necessarily know how to calculate that, but we could probably guess for ourselves what we think is a lighter mitzvah, is a more serious mitzvah. The Rambam says, what's a great example of a light mitzvah? Learning Hebrew. Learning Hebrew, he calls it mitzvah kala.
It's interesting. I wonder how much of modern Hebrew would fall into the category of Lashon HaKodesh.
Of Lashon HaKodesh, yeah.
It's the same language, yeah. But it's entirely different.
It's a good point.
A lot of Arabic.
You spent time in Israel.
No, it's true, like, when you learn a new language, the first thing is one of the swear words in that language, right?
Right.
So I...
Arabic.
The first thing.
So I purposely never learned swear words in Hebrew. Because I was like...
They can't exist,
right? Yeah. Like, well, I had a counselor who was from Ireland, spoke Gaelic, no problem.
A lot of modern Hebrew
also comes from biblical Hebrew.
Right.
Like learning how to say like televisia or chocolates doesn't really seem
correct.
Right, I agree. And being able to read Torah doesn't mean that you can read Harry Potter in Hebrew.
Right. I would take it further and probably imagine that old PON programs are teaching more words like that,
right.
Then they are teaching.
So they might not be fulfilling them.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So you know, how you define Lashon HaKodesh is a good question. Okay, let's get into our final piece here, which is looking at what did Yavan really try to do, and what happened on Hanukkah so important, so critical for really the rest of Jewish history. So there's a midrash which is quoted in many Hanukkah texts, and it's a midrash in source number 9. It's a midrash in Bereshit, right at the beginning, and it's a reference to the opening psukim of Bereshit. So the opening psukim, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha'shamayim ve'et ha'aretz, and the second pasuk is va'aretz hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tahom. Now, this is obviously a description of something that was happening in creation, but the rabbis in the midrash understood these words as a reference to something that would happen in the future, specifically to the four exiles that the Jews would undergo or endure, not necessarily exiles, but four kingdoms, four empires that would be involved in overseeing what was happening to the Jewish people at different points in history. So each word represents a different, each word in that pasuk represents a different empire or a different galut. And the Midrash speaks about them as galuyot, as exile or a state of exile, and that's what's described. So let's look at it together. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish patar karya b'galuyot. He understood this phrase of ba'aretz hatato b'vohu as a reference to the exile. So the first exile the Jews endured was the exile of Bavel, ze galut Bavel. And the word tohu is a reference to Bavel, and they bring a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, which is the time of right before the exile, the Babylonian exile, of the word tohu as a reference to Bavel. Going on, the word vohu, the next word in the pasuk, is madai, media, Persia, that's like kind of became one entity, and they're quoting from the time of history of the book of Esther. Vayavhilu la'aviyat Haman, and that's a kind of a hint to the word vohu, which again is a reference to the second exile. The third, tohu vavohu vechoshech. This becomes the third empire to kind of be in charge of a stage of Jewish history, or history in general, zegalut yavan. This is a reference to the Greek galut, and what was the, and each one kind of represents what that empire brought you know, negatively into Jewish history. And for Greece, it was the idea of choshech, the idea of darkness, which is very apropos for what we do on Hanukkah, of, you know, what the Greeks tried to do. And we bring light, and the whole miracle of Hanukkah, she'ech shicha enehem shel Yisrael b'gzeroteihem, they darken the eyes and the vision of the Jewish people with their decrees. One of their decrees that's mentioned here in the Midrash, Aitau omeret lahem kitvo keren shor, they were supposed to write on the horn of the ox, that you do not have a portion in the God of Israel. And then the last one, Al Pnei Tehom, is a reference to, they don't even name them by name, the Roman Empire, which in the view of Chazal, the view of the rabbis, was the worst, because that was really when they were living. So they lived through that. The rabbis of the Midrash were living through the Roman Empire time, and that was a very, of course, a very difficult time. Hard to compare one to the other, but we know they destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash. But we're focusing on Greece. So the Greeks said, right on the horn of the ox. This is a very strange kind of decree. So I understand you don't want Jews to do circumcision, you don't want Jews to keep Shabbat. These are very fundamental, parts of Jewish life, of Jewish living. But to write on the horn of an ox, like, what is that? I don't have a connection to my God. What does that even mean? So one, there's many pieces that have been written about this. I just took one selection from Rav Chaim Friedlander, beautiful sefer, Siftei Chaim, and he speaks about this concept. But just before that, just think about what the ox is, right? The ox is an animal that's used to work the fields. That's what it was used for, primarily today, till this day. I think it's still used for that feature and function. And writing something on the horn, if you just think about the positioning of that, if you're a person who's working the field, you're going to be looking, basically eye level, right at that spot on the ox. That's what's right in front of you. So if that's what's right in front of you the entire time while you're working the field, that's going to, some point, hit you and maybe even become internalized and could end up negatively affecting a person. But what is the negative effect? So that's what he speaks about. And what he basically talks about is the idea that what Greece was trying to do, what the Greeks were trying to emphasize was the natural world, right? The world that's here in this world. And we'll see how he says it. And this is source 10. Zogam ayta kavanat yivanim gzeratam kitvu keren shor. Look in the second line. Kitvu lachem. Hainu tevaru v'tavhir latzmechem. Ki kasher adam kotev davar. When you write something, hu mishtadel lahavhir et hadvarim yoter. When you write it, so I always have students will say to me, why do I need to write it if all the notes are going to be available after and all these kinds of things? It's true, but we all know when you write something down yourself, you get more clarity and understanding from that experience. Me'asher b'dibur, as opposed to speaking it or trying to just hear it, it's definitely a helpful way to remember things. Your survival and your upkeep is going to be based on using the natural world, using the teva. Sherei hashor, the ox, if there's any animal that represents, you know, this worldliness, it's the symbol of the powers of nature. The hakeren and the horn of the ox, hamivatar achozek shel hashor. That's like the strongest part of the ox. Kilomar, fifth line. Bekach shetichtavu al keren hashor shenem chelak b'lkei Yisrael tashishu dechzaku b'nafshechem et ha'karash ha'teva hu mavir abriya. What are you saying? You're saying that what runs this world is the natural world, right? That's the main driving force of creation. Va'adam bekoach sichlo, and using your intellect, using your wisdom, using your mind. This is really Greek, kind of Greek thinking in a nutshell. What the Greeks emphasized, mishtamesh b'teva, through your intellect, you're able to use the nature kirtzono, according to your will. V'hu bala baido bal kochot, you're in charge. You're in the driver's seat, and you're able to actually manipulate the world through your mind and through the power of nature. Im kein ha'elohim, the idea of God, ha'koach u'bala koach, hu ha'teva, so who is God? God is nature, right? So you're basically in control. What's this idea of God? God is in nature. V'adam, so it wasn't necessarily that they, and this is really the key point here, they're not denying God. They're not denying the concept of a God. They're saying that God works within nature, which isn't so far from maybe what we believe also. Some overlap in that thinking. But the difference is that we are able to have full control over all of these things. And once you say that, you're basically denying, right, the higher role of God in all of this. You can't believe it. So as he says, Mimela tafuga emunah b'Hashem elokeisho shuadon. So you put that right in front of you as you're plowing the field. It's going to be a constant reminder. Who's in charge? Who's in charge? Who's in charge? You're in charge. Right? I don't have a part in Elohei Yisrael. It's basically saying, I'm in charge of my destiny. I'm in charge of everything that's going to happen in front of me. Shuadon ateva kachok kulam b'zot ratzu yivanim l'natekit amisom v'sherach. They tried to cut us off from God. Ulaben mehem yichusam v'yichudam ke'am segula. If you look in source 11, I just brought in the original, one of the original places where this idea is written about the three mitzvot that they tried to abolish. So there it's at the end, Rosh Chodesh, Shabbat, and circumcision, which again, these are all, I think they talk about them as body, time, and I'm trying to remember the other one, how they were all different. Different categories of our Jewish experience. I tried to go against. Yeah, you had it?
No, this might be like totally off topic. Go. But like, why? Like, Rosh Chodesh seems a little bit odd. Like, Rosh Chodesh doesn't have that many halachos.
Right.
Like, why not kosher or?
So I think if you get rid of, I think if you get rid of Rosh Chodesh, it ruins the holidays. It ruins everything else. Right. So it's kind of it's like the
undoing the whole Jewish calendar.
It's the pin that holds everything together, I guess, in a way, the whole Jewish calendar. Yeah.
Okay.
Correct. So back to our original question, which was the question about Torah, which is a question about this. So this is really what the Greeks were trying to do, and it's summed up here in source number 12 and 13, and we'll conclude with these pieces. So the first one is from Rav Gedalia Shor, a sefer called Or Gedalia, and he says, "Lashkicham Torah techel avira michlukei ritzonach," which is a quote from Al Hanisim. "Hayavanim lo ratzu levatel haTorah legamrei." They didn't want to get rid of the Torah. And as we saw, they were very interested in the Torah. They wanted it to be translated into Greek. They knew that the Torah had wisdom. And that was part of the motivation. Right? They translated it into Greek. Had it translated. They saw the Torah as a book of wisdom. But that's it. They saw it as a book of wisdom. As any other book of wisdom. And that was really the battle. One of the main battles of Hanukkah, Ratzu Shiyah Torah Rak B'Torat Chochma. We'll put it on the shelf, and it's just another book of philosophy, another book of wisdom. It's another book of ideas. The Lokadavar Kadosh V'Na'ala, not as something holy, as elevated. V'Kamoshi Amru Chazal Chochma B'Goyim Ta'amin. Is there such a thing as wisdom by the non-Jews? Yeah. They believe that there's an idea of wisdom. They don't have a connection to the idea that the Torah is something that is above other wisdoms. It's a level of kedusha. It's part of, you know, an infinite wisdom of Hashem. That's the part that the Greeks were fighting against. Seeing Torah as something that is not just another form of wisdom. So also, or like put it differently, not just another university class, right? Thinking about it that way. And that's summed up here in the bottom source. There's a fundamental difference between the Greek culture and philosophy and that of Israel. Greek philosophy and knowledge is the product of human endeavor and the study of the natural environment of the world. The Greeks developed the natural sciences in order to learn to harness the world's resources for their own benefit. The better one understands how the world functions, the more practical uses he can make of it. Indeed, the world was created for man to use for his needs. So if you ask, you know, today, does the world still carry this Greek idea? Very much so. So the influence of that concept, which is over 2,000 years ago, is still alive and well today. It's very interesting to see the impact of that. The issue is that the Greeks' approach was that man must rely totally on his own intellect and powers of reason. They felt that man could learn to control his environment and destiny completely if only he knew how, and that was the goal of man's existence. And they posited that man did not need God's assistance. They chose to ignore him and separate themselves from him. This is the antithesis of the Jewish perspective on the world. To us, the purpose and goal of mankind is to harness all the potential in our hands, to fulfill the will of God, to sanctify the physical entities in the world by using them to serve Him. It's the opposite idea. This was the crux of the struggle between the Greeks and the nation of Israel. And to me, that was really what when the Rambam is talking about when the Rambam is talking about, you know, lashkicham Torah Techa, or however you want to define it, trying to take away our ability to keep Torah, to observe Torah, what he's really speaking about is this idea that the Greeks were trying to undermine our unique relationship to Torah. The Greeks were trying to undermine our unique appreciation that the Torah is not just any other wisdom, is not just any other book of philosophy, but really is something special. So when as we approach the Chag of Chanukah, the Yom Tov of Chanukah, it is something that to me was such a fundamental part of what we were able to undo, meaning the victory of the war and the miracle of the oil, and I think they're both part of this, they're both components, two sides of the same coin, of our ability to push back and say, yes, that the Torah is a book of wisdom. It's true. And if you want to learn it as a book of wisdom, that's up to you how you want to learn it. But we as the Jewish people, we see that there's a unique relationship between us, Hashem, and this Torah. And all of that, we will not allow anybody to take away from us. So with that, wish everybody a good evening. And Chag Sameach. Amen. When we get there. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
I thought that the title of the shiur, the Trojan Horse of Chanukah, was an appropriate title due to the fact that Trojan Horse is a tale about the Trojan War and how the Greeks used a wooden horse, massive wooden horse, in which they hid an ambushing army to fight the enemy. It was a way that they snuck in and were able to make the enemy think that they weren't attacking them, yet they were. When we think about what happened in the Chanukah story, that's exactly what the Greeks were doing. They were infiltrating the Jewish mind, the Jewish way of thinking, by simply saying, we're not going to destroy your way of thinking, but we're going to make you think that your way of thinking is not anything more special than any other way of thinking. That your wisdom, that your Torah is just like any other wisdom. That was the Trojan horse of Chanukah. Because it was subtle, it was sneaky, it was an attack that we wouldn't necessarily have noticed, and in fact, in many cases, so many Jews lost their way because of that subtlety. That's how much greater the miracle of Chanukah really was.